redwood forest, Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, Lend-Lease, episode 18. It is now January 5th, 2020. This is our first episode of 2020 on, I guess, our 2019 podcast spinoff, but we will be wrapping up the podcast in just a few weeks and returning to the air with our standard Arsenal for Democracy radio show in February. Joining me this week is just Nate. Hi, Nate. Welcome back.
Hey, Bill. Good to be here.
So we have a relatively light show this week, partly because Rachel was unfortunately sick today. So we decided that for our first episode, since we did a pretty heavy episode last week of recapping the whole decade, me and Rachel, Nate and I are going to be doing a little bit of a lighter one this week, doing a movie corner episode. Sometimes on the regular Arsenal for Democracy radio show, we would talk about some movie or something. I have not seen a huge number of movies this year because I was busy running for office. Rachel has not seen very many movies this year, so that was another reason to do this when she wasn't on. And Nate, in contrast, went to see a lot of movies this year.
I both went to see a lot, and then like from other things that I've watched, I counted it up, and there's like probably some that I forgot, but it's like 133 or something. I don't know why. I just got into a groove of it, so...
Big year at the movies for our boy Nate. So I have only seen two of these. One of them I saw with you, Nate. And we're not going to go into a lot of detail about them. We're going to try to avoid spoilers and just sort of talk about some of the political angle or discourse or whatever that has been around these movies. You have compiled quite a lengthy list of ones that you wanted to note that there was some particular political angle on this year, whether it was in the movie itself or how people were talking about it. Although I see that we do not have Star Wars on here. I think that's probably for the best. There's a lot of discourse.
That would require a whole other thing.
Right. So not talking about Star Wars. Nate, which movie should we start talking about here?
I guess since it's first on the list, Little Women. Boys Chat, Little Women.
This is because Rachel's not here. This is the No Girls Allowed Boys Chat review of Little Women. So we both saw this. What did you want to talk about with this?
Since I'm much newer than you are to the whole story, like I've never read the book or really seen the other adaptations in their fullest, I really enjoyed it. And I thought, and maybe you can explain more or whatever, how it varies between other adaptations, but the whole way it was edited, cut together, jumping across time, sort of showing how the relationships developed between the sisters and with Laurie and everything. Thought that was interesting. And then it sort of, and apparently this is one of the few adaptations that sort of makes it more explicit that Joe, the character Joe, is the avatar of Louisa May Alcott and sort of shows the process of her writing the book.
Mm-hmm.
And then I felt like it really did delve into like the socio-political implications of marriage at the time and the professions, like how could women actually earn money? It shows, you know, them basically struggling. Joe cuts her hair to get money. There's also the Civil War is raging as well. You had Bob Odenkirk randomly as their father.
And he's a militant abolitionist New Englander.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And they help out the poor. They give out various... their Christmas dinner at one point or breakfast to a very poor family living nearby. And so you sort of see the references or the influences of Louisa May Alcott's feminist, abolitionist, and transcendentalist upbringing. So I thought that was interesting. I don't know what your thoughts were.
Yeah. So as Nate said, there's a sort of canon of all these women's novels from the late 18th and most of the 19th century. I did read most of those growing up. It's fine that the Little Women's not necessarily one of my favorite ones of those. So I thought the movie was fine. I was a little frustrated by some of the level of hype around it. Again, not saying it was
bad. Yeah, and all the discourse
anything,
like,
yeah,
oh, men won't go to see it, or it's okay if you go to see it, men.
Maybe right, that yeah, that always seems a little overwrought to me.
It was like before the movie had even come out.
Right,
so I was like,
yeah,
how do we know?
Yeah, it hadn't come out yet, and they're like, no men are going to go see this because they're bad. It was just like, again, has not come out yet. Let's maybe at least save the articles and the weird, I don't know what you want to call it, just berating. Yeah, I almost didn't go see it. I did. I went with my family. It was fine. I, you know, like you said, there's some cool political elements in the actual plot of the movie. But I was very frustrated with some of the discourse around it and everything, especially because, it seemed like to me there was some conflating going on of like, you know, that we have to go see this movie because, women's stories need to get more attention from support. Hollywood, et cetera, and support. If we don't see this movie in theaters, then more of these movies won't get made. But of course, this is like an adaptation of something that's been adapted many times. That was something that I saw other people, like women, commenting on. They were just like, there's been like 27 versions of this. Like, I don't feel a compelling need to go see it, right, or whatever. I could respect that position. And I just didn't really like the whole just narrative around it. I felt like was kind of just a marketing thing in the way that we've seen with, you know, there was the whole
Ghostbusters
discourse stuff. There was the whole,
there were
various other Melissa McCarthy movies and things like that, which I went to see some of those. A lot of them were really great. But like this whole thing about like, if you don't go see this, then like you're letting down but Hollywood producers are some of the like least rational morons on the planet. Like the idea that they're gonna be like, oh, this very successful property that's extremely bankable, that did well in a movie helmed by Greta Gerwig and these big stars, like, oh, that means we should make a whole bunch of other movies about women. I just don't see that happening.
Well,
even if that would be a smart play financially, and so I get frustrated
Couple things, though. Yeah. So I guess like in terms of like the originality or whatever, just worth noting that Greta Gerwig, her previous her directorial debut, also starring Saoirse Ronan, extremely well received. Lady Bird. I have actually not seen it, but after this, I'm definitely meaning to. So it's not like these sorts of films like didn't exist. And I think it's pretty clear that Greta Gerwig is going to get a lot more opportunities, considering that a lot of people really like this movie. And I think it did quite well. So,
right. And obviously there was some stuff that like, you probably were in the same position. There were some things that some people were really, really into this movie about that we just weren't going to be able to relate to or whatever. I mean, I saw a lot of people talking about female friendships and themes like that. Although
I thought those parts were pretty well, except that
they're sisters. People kept talking about it as female friendship, but they're sisters.
That's true. It's also worth noting there's going to be a bunch of like female led superhero movies coming out next year, between like Wonder Woman, the Margot Robbie Harley Quinn movie, and there's another one, Black Widow. So
yeah, although by the same token, those aren't necessarily either advancing the cause of feminism, because they're just more superhero movies, which I think a lot of people are getting fatigued. And that's actually could be a problem too, because you might end up having a situation where people aren't going to see as many of those movies next year, and people will be like, it's because they were women, as opposed to like, it's because they've made 50 movies. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, that's true. I did go see Captain Marvel. Was that this year? I don't even remember.
Yeah, that was early this year. I mean, that was fine.
I enjoyed it, but some people,
my thought. It's like, hopefully these are just like, they'll be fun. Like some of the trailers look pretty good for some of these, but you never know. But anyway, we should probably move on.
Yeah. Let's move on. Why don't we talk about Knives Out, since that's the other one that I saw. And you and I saw that together. I loved it. I just absolutely loved it. Had a great time. It was fantastic. What did you think?
Oh yeah, definitely. It had a very sort of New England WASPy feel. And I think Ryan Johnson filmed it, I think, near Boston or somewhere in the area. So it sort of had.
Yeah,
that.
Both of these movies were filmed in Massachusetts, largely.
Yeah, and. You know, it sort of had that we were talking about. There aren't a lot of these sort of murder mystery type movies. I mean, there was the Murder on the Orient Express last year. And actually next year, apparently they're making a Death on the Nile movie with the same Hercule Poirot from Murder on the Orient Express. But yeah, there aren't a lot of these types of movies now. And they're the kind of movies that I really enjoy. And it inspired me to go back and watch like the 70s version of Murder on the Orient Express. And just sort of these whodunit things I feel like are not made as much anymore. And Rian Johnson definitely did sprinkle in some of the, sort of Twitter political discourse that he clearly had been paying attention to ever since The Last Jedi came out.
Yeah, I guess some people didn't like that, but I thought it was fine. I didn't find it heavy-handed. I found it all like just this is a relevant thing that is taking place in the world in which it is set. Like,
right. And some people complain that's like, oh, the child that he made into like an alt-right like Nazi troll or whatever. Oh, this kid was too one-dimensional. But like, I don't know, those guys
are kind of one-dimensional.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
they're all the
thing.
Same.
Yeah.
They all parrot the same stuff. So
yeah,
that didn't bother me that much.
It was
intricate.
Cool.
It was pretty colorful.
Like Ana de Armas's character, you know, this undocumented character, mm-hmm. where people are sort of like pretending to. No, I think she was a dreamer as well, maybe.
Okay, yeah, yeah. And they kept changing, like, what country was from, because they clearly couldn't remember.
That thing about, you know, these people pretending to be respectful of her or whatever, and just, like, absolute contempt when the mask comes off or the knives come out, you know?
Yeah, or how he's, like, one of the uncles, like, is making sort of, like, pro-Trump arguments and then says to her, like, oh, but she came here the right way. She's one of the good ones. And then he, like, hands his, like, empty tray to her because, I mean, ultimately she's just the help. So
yeah, any other Knives Out related comments other than people should go see it?
No, I mean, probably try to stay so you don't know the twist ahead of time, although there's sort of several twists or whatever. So
a lot of twists. All right, one that I have not seen yet but you have seen, I'm thinking about going to see it because it's still in theaters because it's doing very well, is Parasite. That's definitely a very political one that's generated a lot of commentary, so talk about that.
Yeah, Bong Joon-ho, a lot of people have seen Snowpiercer, very sort of well-known movie about class conflict on a train in a post-apocalyptic world.
Another Chris Evans joint.
Yeah, Chris Evans was in that as well. And in addition, one of the main actors in this, Kang Ho-song. So, Bong Joon-ho is a South Korean director and has really made a lot of waves over here in America recently. But I think this movie has sort of pole vaulted him onto like sort of the global stage. And now he's like one of the directors that people talk about in sort of like, you know, high praise or whatever. And the movie sort of is about, I won't try to give too much away because there are some twists, but it's about a extremely lower class family sort of starts in their basement apartment, which is getting like fumigated. And they leave the windows open in order to get some of the free fumigation because there are like stink bugs everywhere in their apartment. And eventually they, the youngest son who sort of goes by Kevin, he gets a job as sort of the tutor for this extremely rich family. And then one by one, the whole family so like infiltrates the rich family, basically getting jobs as like an art teacher. The daughter gets a job as the art teacher for the rich son's kid. And there's the mother gets a job as the maid, basically by they poison the existing maid with like a peach fuzz because she's allergic to peach. And then says she has tuberculosis in order to like get rid of them. They get rid of the driver. So then the father becomes the driver. And it sort of it goes into how these types of class conflicts can, you know, result in members of the same working class being terrible to each other. There was, you know, a very quote that went made its way around Twitter, basically Bong Joon-ho saying that like he was surprised by all of the like there was a strong reaction to his movie all across the world. And he's saying that's because we all live in the same world called capitalism. And it sort of shows the way capitalism functions in order to turn members of the working class against each other and, you know, have them sabotage themselves and everything. And there was an interesting article, Parasite and the Rise of Revolutionary Gothic, by a friend of the show, Connor Rowe Southard. He says, what's different about revolutionary Gothic is it takes class hierarchy and struggle out of the ethereal realm of the thematic and into the viscerally literal. In Parasite, the brooding sense of dread comes not from supernatural possibility, but from material reality. The ghosts are not specters of scorned lovers, but living people who have been pushed down below. These ghosts are very real, resisting on the distances of symbol, even as they stand for so much. Yeah, it sort of shows the various different types of violence, which I won't go into because that'll sort of spoil the end. But
Now,
just one last quote. Revolutionary Gothic doesn't so much urge violence as it admits that you can't have class hierarchy without conflict. Anyone who's been arrested for jumping a turnstile or protesting an oil pipeline will already be intimately aware of this fact. It's the rest of us who need to sit through the shattering of the myth that class divisions can exist without ongoing violence. If Bong is right that we all live in the same country, then we all live in the same haunted house. So I thought this is a really good article that people should check out, and sort of it goes into sort of the thematic elements. But
as usual, we'll have it linked at arsenalfordemocracy.com when the episode comes out. You mentioned the quote from the director and kind of that he was a little bit surprised himself at sort of the global positive reaction that the movie got, partly because he had made it, you know, with a specific Korean context.
Right.
But on the other hand, there were also people, you were showing me an article, someone overinterpreting and thinking that there was no global context for it, and it was only very specific to Korea, which seemed to kind of miss the point as well.
Yeah, I guess this was something I was just looking on Twitter earlier today, and I saw it was some New York Times article, and it's talking about like Confucianism as part of it, and I didn't really feel like that was.
Yeah,
it sort of played into like Orientalist tropes of like, oh, the obedient Asians or whatever,
right? And like, this was about sort of this like Confucian authoritarianism breeding reaction and revenge, as opposed to the violence and innate in capitalism forcing these, you know, violent interactions, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Like, just kind of missing what other people were taking away from it.
Yeah. And the movie itself, I think, is quite well shot because in terms of like showing this conflict, you have the like basement apartment of the poor family that floods at one point, and you sort of see them descend like into the bowels, into the depths of Seoul. And you know, there are sort of like there are shots of them going down these long staircases, and there's like their apartment floods and everything. Meanwhile, the rich family in their extremely nice house is like out playing in the rain or camping outside. And it's, you know, it's very stark, the difference. So there's a lot of class conflict in that. And I think a lot of people have already seen it. But if like you, Bill, people haven't, then it's definitely worth checking out.
Okay, what's next?
I guess we'll talk about Bombshell,
mm-hmm.
The film that former guest Chris Hooks was adamant that he had absolutely no interest in seeing. And, you know, I could understand why a lot of people had that reaction. But I had recently seen The Loudest Voice, which was a Showtime or Stars miniseries about Roger Ailes, starring Master and Commander. What's his name? Russell Crowe.
Russell Crowe.
Yeah, so but this one, Roger Ailes was played by John Lithgow and had a very interesting cast. Charlize Theron looking exactly like Megyn Kelly. Nicole Kidman, I thought, did a good job as Gretchen Carlson. Then you had Margot Robbie as like a Tammy Lauren type character. Or there was also the woman who was involved in the lawsuit against Roger Ailes because, you know, he was sexually harassing her and whatnot. So it sort of dives into the very cutthroat nature of Fox News and how everything is like hypersexualized. And basically, you know, there's sexual favors can get you ahead in the workplace. And, you know, this culture of harassment that sort of some of these women are trying to push against. But then it sort of, I thought the movie kind of went easy on them, but it did have, you know, clips of Megyn Kelly saying like, oh, Santa Claus is white or whatever. So it didn't let them off the hook completely, even if it sort of did. I sort of enjoy these sort of political dramas. I think some of the same people that worked on The Big Short and Vice also worked on this. It sort of has a similar storytelling, like docudrama style. I think these the people also worked on there was a Recount movie about the 2000 election. So it's very much like that kind of movie, like rip from the headlines, like recent political dramas. So if you enjoy that kind of thing, it's, you know, it's enjoyable. It's not like super deep or anything or has some profound political message. But I actually did see a lot of very angry Republicans who were like, what about Harvey Weinstein in response to this? And I mean, they probably will make a Harvey Weinstein movie, hopefully at some point. But maybe things are a little too close to home, or it would be interesting to see.
Well, I think the court cases are still ongoing. So, I mean,
still ongoing, and he's still actually out there and stuff. He was at some party recently.
Whereas like Ailes is dead, right? So
right, yeah, he died shortly after he got ousted.
A different situation.
But yeah, Lithgow is great as Ailes, and there are some genuinely like disturbing and creepy scenes in it where he's harassing women. So that's interesting.
Next up, relevant to the situation unfolding in Iraq and Iran, you saw the movie Official Secrets.
Oh, yes. I saw this yesterday, actually. Keira Knightley plays a GCHQ signals intelligence analyst, Catherine Gunn. This is a real story, and she leaked documents to The Observer, I believe, during the lead up to the Iraq war, basically saying that the U.S. was pressuring... trying to like fix the vote at the UN to go to war, basically. And I guess she had gotten a memo through her, you know, as she was reading the various intelligence analysts and basically saw that this is what they were planning to do, and eventually helped leak it out. And so the movie covers, you know, her trying to avoid getting caught. And then there's a whole drama with her husband, who's I believe he's Kurdish, but from Turkey originally. And there's the threat of him getting deported and them trying to smear her. And there's also a sort of journalist drama. He's trying to figure out, you know, get it published. Is this legit? So I think that this is a, you know, quite exactly the kind of film that you need at a time like this, like as possibly ramping up for war. Or there was just after the killing of Soleimani, the Pentagon, I think at the press conference, like someone brought up the Iraq war, and it's like, oh, don't trot that out, blah, blah, blah. What
possible relevance could it's like,
so long ago, blah.
And because you were at the movies when all this was unfolding, but they had like Ari Fleischer live on TV, I think even with maybe Karl Rove or somebody like that, basically just being like, almost verbatim, they will greet us as liberators. Like,
yeah, I mean, it's the same thing all over and over again.
It's the same people making the same exact lines. It's a total lie. I mean, and this has been a problem on the Democratic side, too. You have a lot of people, you know, well, how come they keep, all these Bernie Sanders people keep bringing up the fact that he voted against the Iraq war? You know, well, this is old news. Why are you still bringing this up? It's like, because we still have people running for president who voted for it. It is
relevant.
We're still
bombing Iraq.
Yeah, we're still there. Like, you know, as we're recording this today, there's just been a vote by the Iraqi parliament to try to expel U.S. forces from the country, which probably won't happen because there's just basically a permanent fortified occupation all over the country.
Yeah, Pompeo dismisses Iraqi leaders' call for all foreign troops to leave is the headline from 20 minutes ago.
All right. Next thing up.
I guess to go along with that, there's the report. Starring Adam Driver about the report into the CIA torture investigation, or the Senate report into the torture by CIA. And, you know, this sort of goes into, you know, all of the different things that, you know, we've heard, but it dramatizes it in an interesting way. And it sort of shows how the Senate investigation was hampered by both CIA and some of the senators. I don't think Feinstein comes out great in this movie because I guess he's the Adam Driver is working for her as like a Senate staffer. And, you know, this report, basically, you know, there are people that leave the investigation. It's sort of its toll on him. But I mean, it definitely does explore these kind of extremely damaging torture techniques that we used, whether it's waterboarding, very stressed positions, or like the coffins basically that we put people in. I don't think it went into some of the more disgusting stuff like rectal feeding and things that they do in the Guantanamo and stuff. But I thought this was an interesting movie, and that sort of that did delve into these extremely dangerous things that the U.S. Continues to do basically all around the world. So.
The report itself is something we've talked about previously on Arsenal for Democracy. It is something that we mostly know most of the details just because one of the Democratic senators finally did just exercise his power to basically get the, or at least part of the report out. But yeah, there were a lot of senators trying to block the release of it. There was also, like, at one point, the CIA literally hacked Senate computers to try to monitor this, like, investigation, which just, like so many other things of the past 5 or 10 years, has just passed without incident, remark, or consequence.
Well, the CIA is good now. They're woke.
Yeah, well, and I mean, you gotta wonder about all these
CIA people openly running for Congress these days. It's a bit troubling.
Or not so openly.
Some of them are literally, you know, openly like, yeah. I am a former CIA agent and I'm running for Congress. And a lot of them got elected. And like, I think that should be concerning to a lot of people just because that's not really like the background that we need to have a separate civilian branch of government. Next movie.
Permanent branch of government. I guess the next one, which also sort of fits into this theme, is Dark Waters, which is a movie that I think was also produced by Mark Ruffalo, but he stars in it as well. Ruffalo is, you know, among the Hollywood actors, I would say one of the more outspoken for progressive causes, you know.
Yeah, he gives like Eugene Debs speeches and stuff like that.
So I think, you know, this is very much his kind of movie because the movie goes into the DuPont Company and how they basically poisoned the water supply in West Virginia for decades and caused all sorts of birth defects and cancers and like lymphoma and all these different things. So the movie starts off with this farmer comes to him who, I mean, he's like a corporate defense attorney. So he works at this law firm that is often like defending DuPont. So he sort of knows the ins and outs of everything. But, you know, like 150 of the cows had died. So at some point, you know, he's just requesting all the documents and pouring through them and discovering that by their own standards, they had been poisoning people for a long time. They knew it was bad, but they just didn't really care. At one point, I think DuPont gets the government to basically lie for them to change their like minimum accepted standard of various Teflon. So the whole issue in this movie is the Teflon waste, which they had been pouring into the water and causing all of these birth defects and whatnot. And actually, it was interesting. They actually had some people from West Virginia, that specific town, who had suffered from birth defects, including this guy who was born with one nostril, and he was in the movie. They put him in the movie as like someone he runs into at a gas station. Ruffalo sees him at a gas station. He'd already heard about this guy, and then he's like, wait, is this that guy? And it was actually, I guess his name, Bucky. And they cast him in the movie. So I thought that was quite interesting. And yeah, it really goes into just how the extent to which these corporations will just poison you and then not really care and then fight to deny it and fight their way out any liability for it. So the actual character Ruffalo is playing, or the actual guy in real life, you know, spent a lot of time in court fighting for these payments for the victims. And then eventually I think DuPont sort of had to do a settlement, but it required just decades, I think, of legal wrangling and just trying to fight for the basic right for clean water for these people, which is rapidly no longer a right. So,
all right, next movie.
I guess we briefly talk about The Irishman, Martin Scorsese's version of Avengers Endgame with all the CGI de-aging or whatever.
Yeah, that was your hottest take, I think, of the year was telling me that this was Martin Scorsese's Avengers Endgame and it had all your favorite characters in crossing over.
Yeah, he pretty much had the guys that he's worked with and for a long time, and you know, Pesci sort of came out of retirement to do his role as Don Buffalino, and of course he's worked with De Niro all the time, so. You know, and that wasn't even meant as like a criticism. And actually, a lot of Scorsese has, I think, walked back some of his criticism of Marvel or whatever. But without diving too deeply into that, the Irishman touches on a lot of political subjects, including everything from Bay of Pigs to Watergate, you know, to possibly the JFK assassination. And sort of it goes into the memoirs of which I'd heard about previously of. I Heard You Paint Houses is the title of his memoir, and I think the alternate title of the movie, because they don't actually say The Irishman in the opening credits anywhere. They just say I Heard You Paint Houses. And so it goes into his claims that he was like a right-hand man for a long time and then eventually killed Jimmy Hoffa, leader of the Teamsters, and it sort of goes into the political wranglings of the Teamsters. At one point, Hoffa's, you know, yelling, solidarity, solidarity. Pointing out the importance of like workers and shippers on like the trucks. So, like if you got anything in America, a truck brought it to you, sort of demonstrating the
The potential choke points.
Yeah, exactly. The key infrastructure that the Teamsters had. So
I did not watch this movie. A few discourse points, though, that I wanted to highlight.
About the corruption of unions? Is that what we're
talking
about?
So, I think the two worst takes, again, I didn't see the movie, so maybe I'm wrong on this. But anyway, the two worst takes on this were the people being like, Jimmy Hoffa did nothing wrong. Which is just, that's incorrect. Relatedly, saying, that the timing of this movie is suspicious. You know, it's meant to paint unions in a bad light and damage the burgeoning resurgence of unionism among, you know, young people and so forth. I think that's a bad call because people like
Wasn't
Jimmy
Boots
Hoffa.
Riley saying that?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
But he said the second thing, not the first thing, about Jimmy Hoffa did nothing wrong.
Right.
The thing is, it is something that the union movement, if there's going to be a true resurgence, needs to grapple with, which is that you can't have mobbed up unions doing blatant corruption, cutting side deals with, you know, management and whatever, and all this other stuff. It's bad, right? That's the thing that's damaging to unionism, not this movie. The movie is not like, this is going to do more damage. Part of the reason that unionism in this country fell apart was not just, you know, a sustained campaign by the government against it. It's also the fact that you had this corrupt, you know, stuff for these mob bosses, these, you know, union bosses that didn't listen to their membership, things like that. The rank and file strategy, which is something we've talked a lot about on this show, is explicitly a counter to that. We've talked about a whole bunch of different unions over a whole, not just recently, but also in that same contemporaneous time period, struggling with, you know, their, you know, you had rank and file people trying to make positive change within their unions getting assassinated and things like that. We talked about that in relation to, I think it was the mine workers.
Well, that's depicted in the movie as well, too. So, and also them stealing their pension funds to like invest in like mobbed up casinos and stuff like
that. This is undeniably a problem that affected the union movement very negatively, and failure to grapple with that is going to result in the same thing happening again.
Yeah,
so,
I also saw someone note on Twitter that, like, even, like, this past year or something, like, I don't know, forget which union specifically it was, might have been the AFL, but, like, spending a ridiculous amount of money on, like, cigars and stuff. So it's clearly, like, this kind of type of behavior has not completely gone away. So, yeah. But, I mean, in general, it's an interesting movie, so if you have the time to check it out, I would recommend it, but it's quite long. So
next up.
Okay. I guess another one we could talk about is The Kill Team, which is, there's also a documentary and a movie based on it, but this, I'm talking about the drama, sort of follows a private in Afghanistan, and it basically, his unit is killing civilians basically wantonly, and 11 U.S. troops in real life were eventually convicted for crimes related to the killings. And I mean, it's extremely brutal. A lot of people get murdered, and sort of follows this private who he sort of goes along with it. He's uncomfortable with it, but he doesn't resist, basically. And eventually he gets charged too. And I think he served a reduced sentence because I guess he testified against his, there was like one specific guy, Sergeant Deeks in the movie, his commander, who was exceptionally brutal. But yeah, just a lot of civilians getting executed by U.S. soldiers, and just not, pretty depressing, but I think because it's based on a true story, it's definitely worth watching and sort of absorbing the brutality that we committed over there and are still committing. So
relevant in light of the recent pardons and so forth.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, this is exactly the kind of behavior that the people that Trump pardoned were engaged in, whether it's just, you know, shooting people for fun or just, you know, whatever. I think the movie sort of portrays interestingly, like, sort of why this is happening. They're sort of out there. They don't really know what they're doing. Like, some people step on an IED or something, and then they determine it's like, oh, they all know where all the IEDs are. There's no innocent civilians, so just kill whoever you want, mutilate their bodies. And that's what they did. So I think it's worth, like, seeing it depicted at the very least. I don't know. I mean, it's not it's not a fun movie, I would say, but yeah, it's there's a lot in there. So
any others on this list that you think are particularly worth highlighting?
Okay, well, we can go quickly. The Two Popes I saw, about Ratzinger and Bergoglio. And I guess in real life, their relationship was not as sort of friendly as this, where they're like eating pizza and watching the World Cup. But it's, you know, it's interesting in just in terms of sort of their dialogue about the direction the church is going. And I guess in this movie, Ratzinger steps down and because, oh, he sees the need for a Bergoglio, and it sort of paints Pope Francis as, you know, more of the people. He's, you know, in the pub watching Messi score on TV during the World Cup.
Not, yeah, as you said, very closely based on actual reality.
Well, yeah, I guess they did meet and, you know, there was that transition. But I think Benedict has sort of, he's been taking a lot of shots at Francis recently, right? I mean, yeah, that's sort of it. If you sort of separate this movie from like what's actually going on, it's enjoyable. I don't know how much politics like you can really glean from it. And I guess another movie that we probably need to talk about because it had such, there's so much discourse about it, but that would be Joker. And, you know, whether it did not inspire anyone to go shoot up a theater, as it turns out, as people seemingly were hoping for, like that was the vibe I got. People wanted there to be a mass shooting.
Yeah, people really were working themselves up into a lather before that movie came out about, and the theaters and were like the again, I think this was a marketing thing. The thing about like, you can't go see it as a single male by yourself. That was a bananas requirement to impose, and I think that absolutely was like a marketing thing to really hype up how twisted the movie was.
Well, I went to see it by myself, so I don't know.
Well, some of the theater chains had that, at least for the opening weekend or whatever, yeah.
There was a no makeup sign, can't dress as the Joker. So, but yeah, and then of course there was a debate, you know, is this sort of nihilistic violence? Is it a working class revolutionary? You know, at the end, there's sort of an uprising. We're all the Jokers now, blah, blah, blah. We all live in a society. And but like the Joker basically says, like, oh, I believe in nothing. And oh, yeah, I don't really care. Like in his climactic speech, he's like, oh, if everyone was just nicer to each other, like that's what you're going for in that moment. Like civility, like the problems in Gotham, like up to that point, weren't the problems of civility. There were giant rats running all around, super rats as they were called. You had people living in extreme poverty. So I don't know. The guy who made The Hangover made this movie, so I think we'd probably be expecting a little too much for like deep political messaging. It's like fun as a movie about the clown who does crimes or whatever. But like, yeah, I don't think that you can take a ton politically out of that. But there was a lot of discourse about it though, which I'm glad we're not really doing that as much now. So
yes, thank mercifully over.
Yeah. A couple other ones, I guess. Midway, pretty by the numbers thing about the Battle of Midway. It did sort of delve into the relationship with the Japanese naval command, Yamamoto and whatnot, and showed that he had studied in America at Harvard and sort of had appreciation for that. And then, but showed basically how the U.S. was able to outsmart him. And Admiral Nagumo and destroy all of the Japanese aircraft carriers. So, I mean, the movie wasn't great, but it was sort of, I do enjoy seeing like a pretty historically significant battles being depicted. So that was at least worth watching just for that, I guess. Also two other ones that I liked, Jojo Rabbit, a Holocaust comedy. Very dark, but also quite funny. Taika Waititi playing imaginary friend Hitler for this young boy who then discovers he has his mother had hidden a young Jewish girl in the attic, and basically gets to know her and has his bigoted mythology about Jews sort of dispelled or whatever. And, you know, this is the kind of movie that could very easily be very offensive and very bad, or just like, you know, in extremely poor taste. But it's Taika Waititi, so he kind of knows what he's doing, and it comes off, you know, very heartwarming and also funny and sad and all of the things that I think that you would want out of this type of, you know, period comedy or whatever, where it's, yeah, I mean, it's not.
I think I saw an interview with him where he made some comment about, you know, having him as a non-white person do like the Hitler character, you know, Charlie Chaplin-esque or whatever, but like, you know, that it was made it work better for him to do it that way.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think he pretty much, I don't know if the studio required him to do it, but I think it very much worked because it was him, and he has a very like sort of distinct comedic persona. And I feel like he's also similar to Bong Joon-ho, is now becoming like one of the more talked about directors. He was also involved in the Star Wars TV show Mandalorian. So he's all over the place. And I guess maybe one other one that we could talk about quickly would be The Lighthouse, which is black and white movie where you have Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson just going crazy in a lighthouse together.
Is it in Maine? Is that where it takes place?
Yeah, or? Yeah. Coast of Maine. Although apparently it was inspired by some event that happened like off the coast of Scotland, maybe, where these lighthouse keepers were stranded, and then people come back later and like one is found like hung or something. And but it basically shows these two in the lighthouse, and people have analyzed it a bit just about the sort of boss and employee relationship, because Willem Dafoe is often on Robert Pattinson to, you know, do more work or seemingly, you know, monotonous tasks. Then later Pattinson finds like a book, like a notebook that Dafoe had written, basically saying like, I should not offer him like any recommendations or something. Or I think it was even like withholding some pay or something, because he hadn't done like these alleged things that he was supposed to do. But, you know, he clearly had been working really hard. So it does touch a bit into that sort of, you know, employer-employee relationship there. And also sort of that period of the, like sort of around the turn of the century there, or maybe slightly before, where you could sort of become someone else. Like there's a bit into, they go delve into the backgrounds of these two characters a bit, and you could sort of move and steal someone's name or something and become someone completely different, and then go out to a lighthouse or something. And then
it's very Sister Carrie, which is also contemporaneous, I think, approximately to that period. Of there's a lot of like, oh, just move to a different part of the country and build a whole new identity for yourself and leave everything behind.
And that movie is, you know, very strange. They're all speaking in like Melvillian English and trying to copy the Mainer accents of like people, like fishermen from the 1800s or whatever. So it's a very unique kind of movie, but I had the extreme amount of fun watching. So definitely I would recommend checking that out if you sort of like, there's sort of like a Cthulhu horror element, Lovecraftian a bit. There's like mermaids and tentacles and all that fun stuff. So, but maybe not the most political of all these movies, but it definitely had some elements of that.
All right. Well, that concludes our movie corner, wrapping up 2019 as we head into 2020. And especially a lot of these, I think, are from the latter half of the year. And even just the last few weeks in many cases. All right. We will be back soon. As I said, we've got a few more episodes this month in January, and probably, I think, maybe the first week of February. I'll have to look at the calendar before we return to the air. And that will be a half hour format show. We've been a little bit flexible on the length of the episodes when it's the podcast version, but we will be returning to the half hour format from before the podcast. All right, Nate, thanks for being here this week.
Thanks a lot, Bill.